I'm Becky McRae, and today we are talking with Ben Winchester. So, Ben, why don't you tell folks, I know that you're with the University of Minnesota, tell folks where you are and what you do.
Sure. Hi, Becky. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me. My name is Ben Winchester. I'm a research fellow with the University of Minnesota Extension, Center for Community Vitality. A little bit of a mouthful there, but we do a lot of great things across the state. This is kind of a newer area, I would say, within Extension, this Community Vitality initiative or center that we've got here. It's maybe 10 years old now, so, I mean, relatively new in terms of Extension. And we do a lot of work across the state in terms of leadership development, civic engagement, and economic development activities. And my role really, I would say, is twofold. I do a lot of internal evaluation. So when we claim to say we're doing things, I make sure that we can make that claim. And on the other side, I've got a research agenda that that is somewhat under the umbrella of what I call rewriting the rural narrative. And I've got two different topics within that that I look at. One is migration and the other is leadership development. And this really, for me, arose from graduate school, where I went to the University of Missouri Columbia in their rural sociology program, and I quickly realized that rural is not all agriculture. So I started to look more deeply, I guess, at the data. And I'm a, what I would call a self-proclaimed data geek. I love data. I like to help people understand data. And that's really kind of the angle I've got here.
Okay, so I mean, you packed a lot into just a quick introduction. I really love the idea of the Center for Community Vitality, Center for Community Vitality.
Yeah.
That's a really broad umbrella and lets you guys pack a lot of different topics into just one center. I know that Extension in my area does a lot of work with local officials and building their capacity, and as well as does a lot of economic stuff. So I can see where Extension's probably putting a lot of things together under the idea of community vitality.
Yeah, exactly. And really, we've had educators doing work like this for many years. It just wasn't necessarily called community vitality. Minnesota was a little bit at the forefront here where a number of years ago now we moved to a regional center kind of strategy where we no longer have kind of the county-based system where you used to have county educators. And we're now housed out of regional centers, and educators have regions within our work areas. So at this time is somewhat when the Center for Community Vitality was created. So it was just a good timing in terms of the restructuring that was being done in Minnesota.
Cool. Okay, so the other thing that you mentioned there was rewriting the rural narrative, and that's the thing that really got my attention. I know that you're known for talking about brain gain, but that's part of it. But I really love the idea of just even the title of rewriting the rural narrative, because I think that's what we're doing. Rural areas don't stand still. They don't remain the same any more than any other part of the world remains the same over time. And so it's time to rewrite the narrative. We have to talk about what rural is like today and quit talking about what rural used to be like way back when. I remember when. Tell us a little bit about rewriting the rural narrative. And what you
sure. I mean, we've really been using, I would say, a deficit approach to describe what's going on in our rural communities. So, you know, the young kids are all leaving, out-migration is a problem, rural areas are dying / bleeding. I mean, you name it, we've seen the headline. But really, as I started looking at the data, I realized that, you know, since 1970, the rural population across the United States has actually gone up by 11%. It hasn't gone down. So when I started looking at media articles and headlines, it was more about the relative proportion or percentage of people living rural that has gone down. And we have. We've declined from, you know, in Minnesota here where, you know, 50% of the people would live in a rural area 50, 60 years ago, down to 18% today. But that doesn't mean that fewer people are living in a rural place. So, you know, my undergrad was in math and statistics, so I love looking at the data and trying to dig a little bit deeper into what the actual trends are. So beyond the headline or beyond the total numbers, we do have overall increases. And, of course, there is variation within that. So, you know, some of our counties, our rural counties, have had population increases. Some have had declines. So even within that, there's kind of a mixed bag. But overall, we can't let some of the headlines drive what is happening in our rural communities. So we do know that rural areas have changed significantly. I mean, the early 1900s, we had the mechanization of agriculture, which led to a great reduction in the number of farm workers. We had roads and transportation systems being created, where really no town was going to be a one-stop shop. So we had rural developers, in a sense, running across the rural countryside, saying, you know, we need to fill up our main streets with businesses, we need to have our doctors, we need to have our lawyers, we need to have our grocery stores, our kind of hardware stores. Everybody was competing against one another. But not everybody could sustain that. And as we started to approach 1950, the rise of regional centers really took over. And this is where some of the small towns started to lose some of their main street businesses. We started to see schools struggle in trying to maintain their enrollment numbers, especially true in the 30s, but again in the 70s, that was happening. So really the first half of the 20th century was a great upheaval in terms of the economic base. The agricultural changes and the restructurings we saw there had a big impact. And then in the latter half of the 20th century, we started to see more things like the main street restructurings, and this was really the rise of globalization was impacting not just rural areas, but urban areas alike. And I think if there's one key message I've got is that a lot of the changes that we're seeing in rural areas are not distinctly rural. They are happening in urban areas alike. So when we see a hardware store close in White Bear Lake, Minnesota, a suburb of St. Paul, it's not as apparent because they've got three or four other hardware stores that people can go to. But in a small town, you lose your only hardware store, and it has a very big visual and social impact on that community. But it's not a distinctly rural phenomenon. So, and we started to see restructurings in terms of hospital closings and school consolidations and churches. And, you know, if there's any constant, it's change, is that our urban and rural communities have been changing alike. So then I started looking at the data from the 1970s and forward. And this is really during the period of time in the 70s, we had what was called a rural revival or a rural rebound. And this wasn't just like back to the land kind of folks. This was actually a true societal preference for living in a rural place. And the rural population, I mean, 2.2 million more people moved from the city to the country than vice versa in the 90s even. It started in the 70s. There was a slowdown in the 80s. The rural migration picked up huge in the 90s. And it continued even through the 2000s, though it wasn't as heavy in the 2000s because the price of gas started to go up, and the housing crisis kept almost everybody in place, not just rural folks, but urban folks alike. So I started digging a bit deeper into the migration data, and this is really one arm of my research, is that, you know, there's a lot of, I would say, rural sociologists, there's books like Hollowing Out the Middle out there that, you know, apparently when we're losing our kids, that we're going to take the right turn into the ditch if we don't stop this migration of kids away from our rural communities. But migration theorists will tell you that you need to encourage migration, not just in our small towns, but in our country. This is called social capital, and this is how you build social capital, is you bring people in as people leave. And so there's been this trade-off. While we lose our young people, we have witnessed an increase in the number of 30 to 49-year-olds moving into our rural communities. So the migration model is this. We lose our high school kids. They move into the core metro or a college county. Then they move into basically a core metro for job training. But by the 30s, these people move away from the core metropolitan counties to our suburbs and rural areas alike. So, it's an interesting interchange here to see that, you know, core urban areas like, yeah, I'm familiar with Minnesota, so Hennepin and Ramsey County, where Minneapolis and St. Paul are, they're the biggest attractor of 18 to 25-year-olds in the state. But over the age of 30, they can't hold on to people. So the fact is, people are not all flooding to the city across all age ranges. It's a very narrow age range. But we do see this influx of 30 to 49-year-olds. So this is why I call the research I do the brain gain. And it's really to counter the negativity around the brain drain, whereby, again, our young people are choosing to leave. And I just don't think it's a healthy social policy to tell our kids that they should not be leaving. What we do want to tell people is that our rural communities are vibrant places for people of all ages and all backgrounds to be invited to. And it's not just back to. So a lot of people, when I show them their data, when I show these 30 to 49-year-olds moving in, say, oh, that's our kids coming back. Well, actually, just 20 to 30% of all these newcomers had any previous contact with that community, which has been very interesting. So it's not just young people moving back to their home communities. These are people moving into rural communities from all places. We have people from New York, from California, from Montana, moving into rural Minnesota. So, I mean, the data painted the picture for us. And then we started to do hundreds of interviews and focus groups to ask people, why did you move to a rural community? And the top three reasons they gave were slower pace of life was number one, safety and security is number two, and the low cost of housing is number three. And really, as you mentioned too in your somewhat promo for this, is that, you know, jobs wasn't even in the top eight. It wasn't even
right.
To me, that was
like the most significant thing, because everyone says we've got to have more jobs so that we can attract and hold on to more residents. It's all about jobs. And you said that's not what people say that move in.
No, and, you know, jobs is an important factor, but it's not the reason why people are moving to a rural community. So this started to get me thinking a lot more broadly about the rural trends, and that is, where would our rural communities be if these people had never been coming back in the 30 to 50 age range? So I looked at some of our population data, and even in some of our rural counties where we did lose 2 to 3 to 4% of our rural population, that number would be around 12% if we never had people moving back. So this is when I throw that into the mix to show that overall our population losses are not across the board. They tend to be very localized to narrow age ranges. So it's when the number of kids leaving our rural communities outweighs the number moving in, then we see overall population loss. So even as you change your sign outside of town every 10 years that says our population went from 770 to 750, that's not people across the board. That tends to be the loss of either the very young people, the 18 to 25, or the older people as they move out to live closer to family or to go to senior facilities. But we've got this real sweet spot, I would say, in rural migration patterns that show 30 to 50-year-olds, these are people with pretty severe career profiles. They've got great earning potential. They've got good career contacts. These people are moving out. They're starting businesses at higher rates than we ever thought we would see. They're telecommuting from urban and suburban areas alike, and they're taking on the jobs that are in our rural areas. But this, from an economic development point of view, tells us that just because a business doesn't have a physical presence in your community, don't think that an urban business doesn't have a presence, because they may actually have employees in our rural communities that are representatives of this statewide business at that point. So there's a lot of implications here that are fairly deep, and I'm trying to shorten this up into, you know, something that's manageable here in terms of time. This is usually almost a two-hour presentation I give on some of the background factors.
See, nobody from Extension can do anything in a 10-minute chunk without 200 PowerPoint slides, right?
And we're educators. We want to teach, so that's where we're at.
I get it. So let me interrupt for 1 second, because sure. There's a number I want to throw out that I found in one of your previous discussions, and that was the brain gain. The new households are worth about $92,000 per new household.
Yes.
I mean, that's a pretty significant economic impact on your community for each new household that comes in.
It is, and when you start, I mean, that's just a single household per year. And so what we did was we looked at, we call it the economic impact analysis, and we have educators, Bridget Tuck, within Minnesota that did the work for us, that examined, you know, what is the value of a newcomer to a rural community? And really the question was, should we, as an economic development professional, be spending time trying to recruit people as opposed to businesses? And if you want to have a dual strategy here, you know, is it worth our time, was the question. And when we found out that each household was worth $92,000, and this was just in direct and indirect, so money that is made as income and then money that is spent on services and goods within the community, but at the same time, there were other factors that add to this that we didn't even include, and this was contributions to the school district. Because many of these newcomer families are bringing their kids, too. So as we're bumping up school enrollments in 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th grade, they're bringing dollars, statewide dollars, with them, too. So we're able to hire more teachers. We're able to offer more services in our community because we're bringing these dollars. And, you know, in small towns, little numbers mean big things. So, you know, if you've got a town of 700 people and you're recruiting 7 people per year, that doesn't sound like a lot, trying to get 7 newcomers per year. But over the course of 10 years, that's 70 new people in your town, which is a 10% population increase. So these, you know, when we start looking at these numbers, and they're pretty significant, it becomes pretty exciting to think about this in terms of what we call people attraction strategy. And Jim Russell writes for the Pacific Standard, and he's an urban theorist, but we've connected on many urban and rural topics alike to examine these macro trends. And it is less an emphasis on place. That, you know, when we started interviewing these newcomers and they're looking at anywhere between 3 to 5 different towns in a 45-mile radius, no one town is a one-stop shop in a rural community anymore. We like to call our rural communities in the middle of everywhere, because you can, again, kind of working from this no town is a one-stop shop, you live in one place, you work in another, you shop in multiple communities, you play in a 45-mile to a 90-mile radius around your community. I mean, rural people, the more we found out, do not mind traveling. And so when we have our place-based attraction strategies, they're just not compatible with the actual strategies that these newcomers have used when they're looking at 3 to 5 different towns. And if you've got a pool in one town and the good restaurants in another, it's no longer the one-stop shop. It's the one-stop region.
So small towns really have to start thinking a lot more regionally than we have for a long time. If we're going to have a place-based attraction strategy, it's going to have to be based on the entire regional place.
Yes.
As opposed to just our town.
Yep, and that really goes, it almost takes place out the window. That really, it's about how do you get the people? How do you get the people who have an affinity for what we call low-density living? And this affinity for low-density living is backed up by, like, the Pew Research Study did it, one of their studies that looked at what percentage of people would like to live in a small town or a rural place. And we know that 15 to 20% live in a small town or a rural place, but 51% of people would prefer to live in a small town or a rural place. But people, it takes time to think through, you know, what's it going to take to move our family to a rural area? What am I going to, where am I going to find the schools? When are we going to get time to visit these towns? I mean, so this migration has happened without us in the rural development industry doing much. So my point is, what would happen if we actually did something to try to get these people to move to a rural place?
What I want to do here is I want to take a break, because I want to break this into two chunks. I want to do another part of this so that we can share that as two parts of the episode. In the next section, what I'd really love to talk about, and so for everybody that's listening, this will be next week. Yep. Let's talk about the steps that towns and businesses and individuals can take to be part of the brain game. So we're gonna wrap up here for today, and we'll see you guys next week and talk more with Ben Winchester.